From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Writer Daniel Jennis spent 10 years in prison for armed robbery.
By the end of my time, I was well-liked in prison. Everybody knew I had written a novel.
Wait, so what was your identity? Who was Daniel Jennis, the prisoner?
The smart one.
Jennis had a college education and is the son of a famous Russian culture critic. But he developed a heroin addiction and committed the robberies to pay his dealer. Today, Jennis talks about his 10 years in prison.
I had to fight. There were four times when I had to fight.
So how did you hold your own in the fight?
Well, I didn't win them.
Also,
let me get fixed up here.
Country and bluegrass guitarist Norman Blake tells us about his 60-year career in music. And John Powers reviews Seymour, An Introduction, the new documentary directed by actor Ethan Hawke. That's all coming up on Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. The Apologetic Bandit is what our first guest, Daniel Jennis, was nicknamed in the press after he was arrested for robbing people at knife point. He offered apologies to his victims as he took their cash. The money was to pay off his debt to his heroin dealer. This wasn't the direction Jennis's life was supposed to take. He is the son of the Soviet émigré Alexander Jennis, still famous in Russia as a broadcaster and culture critic. Education and culture are prized in Daniel's family, but after college, instead of making a name for himself in publishing as he planned, he was convicted of 5 counts of armed robbery, for which he served 10 years total in maximum and medium security prisons. He was released last year. Since his release, he's been keeping busy writing articles and essays for such publications as Newsweek, The Washington Post, and Vice. He's at work on a memoir about the 1,046 books he read while in prison.
Daniel Jennis, welcome to Fresh Air. I want to start by reading an excerpt of the New York Post article that seems to follow you around in your biography all over. And this is the article that was published November 16th, 2003, after you were arrested. So this is just an excerpt. Cops said in many of the robberies, the man, you, was unfailingly polite, often apologizing profusely to his victims. While he was robbing the victims, he would say things like, "I'm sorry to do this to you," or, "Please forgive me, I need the money, I'm sorry," said a police source. Most of the victims were women, but the oldest one was an 82-year-old man, police said. The robber's usual method was to follow his prey into a vestibule or lobby, confront the victim with a knife, and demand money. Still, in one incident, according to cops, a courteous Jennis, after taking her cash, returned a wallet to a woman he robbed after she asked for it back, telling him that it contained all her identification. The crime binge, while prolific, did not net the suspect a considerable amount of money. In 18 robberies between July 20th and August 21st, Jennis made off with only $700, police said. Okay, so first of all, why did you apologize?
Well, I apologized because I didn't want to do it in the first place. And the whole reason for doing it was because I not only did I have a heroin habit, but I owed some money. I owed a $5,000 bill to a pretty bad Ukrainian, and I paid my bill. But you asked why I apologized, and I was contrite right at the scene of the crime. And it was because I really, really did not want to do this. I had to work my nerve up every time, and I was also really, really bad at it. I had no real access to a weapon, so the knife mentioned is actually a pocket knife. I once used the same knife for camping, but I didn't want to do this, and I did it anyway because drug addiction causes you to compromise. It makes you compromise your morals. William Burroughs said you crawl through a sewer just to have the privilege of buying. And it turned out to be true. In my case, it took less than 2 years to take me to this
now
level.
You're from a middle-class family. You maybe could have asked your parents for the money. No one wants to go to their parents and say, "I'm a junkie now, so I need $5,000 for the Ukrainian drug dealer who might hurt me really badly if I don't pay him." Nevertheless, it seems so especially awful to steal from people when, I mean, you had access to family money, probably.
My father is a public figure of sorts in Russia. He's a big shadow to grow under, and I never wanted to disappoint him. I was raised to be a perfect showpiece of a child. I'm an only child. So admitting that I was an addict, even asking for help, all of it was kind of unthinkable in my home. And I hid everything as best I could. I also hid it from my wife. So perhaps if things were a little looser at home, I could have asked. But it wasn't quite possible in the way I felt at the time.
So you were sent to maximum security prison. You were someone who was defined by the books they read, by the search for some kind of transcendental experience beyond yourself. Now you're in a maximum security prison where a lot of the culture is about power, about what you need to do to earn the respect of others. And that just like wasn't the culture you're from.
Yes. Well, let's talk about that. First of all, it was so obvious that I didn't fit in from I don't know whether they knew from the way I looked, but definitely from the moment I spoke, when I said that my first word, they knew. They knew every time they could smell it on me. I was out of place, didn't belong there. But in any case, when I first got there, I immediately had to make a decision. Was I going to try and pretend and fit in? I could have really had an interest, pretended to have an interest in motorcycles and pit bulls and cage fighting. I could have gone with the flow and try to pretend and try to make it easy on myself and fit in and not be noticed. Or I could take the harder route of being myself and making them respect me anyway. At least it would be easier in the one sense that I wouldn't have to pretend all day. It would be harder because the values that I cherish, which are basically intelligence, are not the things that are valued there. But I chose the second and harder path, and I was myself for 10 years. And it took me a little bit of time to adjust and learn how to maneuver, especially through the hierarchies and status of prisoners. I realized that, in fact, it's not the most violent or the strongest or the scariest of guys. It's actually the ones who are the most manipulative, who are the most important. And to make sure that I was safe and comfortable, I picked up on what was necessary to do in order to be respected and liked.
You're speaking in code now. Tell me something specific.
Well, by the end of my time, I was well-liked in prison. Everybody knew I had written a novel. I moved prisons the moment I got to a new one. Everybody knew who I was. I was a name that the whole system knew.
Wait, so what was your identity? Who was Daniel Jenis, the prisoner?
The smart one.
So what does that get you? What does it get you
it
to
be smart?
It got me.
It got me. Believe it or not, it got me places. Because when people needed something answered or done, they came to me. And at the same time, they respected me because I had never snitched. I understood where I had to. I had to fight. There were four times when I had to fight.
Had you ever fought before?
In the first year. As a child, I mean, it wasn't part of my day-to-day life. And that is not the usual case. A lot of men in there have been fighting all their lives. They have hands that look like rubber or something. You know, they don't look human at all because of the fighting they've gone through. Some actually enjoy it.
So how did you hold your own in the fight?
Well, I didn't win them. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you win them or not. The point is that you participate. You know, to be honest, you're talking about violence that comes from prisoners. But the more dangerous type is the kind that comes from prison guards, because that can kill.
Were you exposed to that?
Absolutely. There wasn't a person who wasn't. And that is much, it's a much more dangerous thing. I've seen people lose eyes, teeth. I've seen dead bodies. And I myself was beaten with my own boot, you know, and if I took my, while that was happening, had I taken my hand off the wall, I would have been beaten by six people with clubs. So, you know, in prison, the monopoly on violence is definitely controlled by the prison guards. So it's a show of force, and they have to be, you know, they're violent. And some of them seek out this career because they have a sadistic or violent streak to them. Others see it as part of the job, but it is a hands-on job. I probably got as little as physically, technically possible. I'm sure, I mean, I think pretty much everybody I met had experienced more than I had, and yet I had experienced some.
Let's talk about the time that you spent in maximum security prison.
7 years out of 10.
Describe the cell that you spent the most time in.
It's nothing pretty, Terry. It's very small. There's a toilet and a sink. It's all one metal unit. There's a cot that's not for anybody who's very wide or very tall. There's a locker. And everything else you kind of build on your own. For example, my refrigerator was a styrofoam box that I filled with ice whenever I could get it. Everything is jerry-rigged. I used to cook on a stove made out of a tin can and a heating element from a coffee machine, which I plugged into the wall. And I would fry on one of those large industrial-sized tuna cans that has 5 pounds of tuna in it. I clean it out and deep fry in it, except that there's no oil. So the way to get it is to freeze a jar of mayonnaise. And the mayonnaise itself freezes and the oil separates and the oil comes out and you poke a hole in it and there's your oil. So there's a lot of ingenious little methods that prisoners have developed over the years to make life more comfortable. And what's interesting about that is that, like you said, I read books all through my time. And some of those books, especially in the beginning, were books about other people's prison experience because that was useful to me. So as a result, I've read all three volumes of Solzhenitsyn's Gulag, Archipelago, and I read everything that there is about prison. And I noticed, even in something as old as Dostoevsky's House of the Dead, that the behaviors described were exactly the same. There was a moment when I was reading about how Dostoevsky was being bothered by a convict who was trying to sell him a chess set he had carved. And while I'm reading this, the man in the cell right next to me is making a chess set out of cardboard and spit in order to sell it to me. So despite the 200 years difference, despite the continents and cultures that separate us, somehow prison brings out the same qualities in man.
Writer Daniel Jenness speaking with Terry Gross last Wednesday. After graduating from college, he was convicted of 5 counts of armed robbery. He used his pocket knife to steal money in order to pay off his debt to his heroin dealer. His heroin habit came as a shock to his new wife and to his parents. His father is a Soviet emigre broadcaster and culture critic who is well known in Russia. Daniel Jenness was released from prison in 2014 after serving a total of 10 years, and he's since written articles for Newsweek, The Washington Post, and Vice. He's at work on a memoir called 1046, which is the number of books he read in prison.
You are not only in your own cell in maximum security prison. You had a couple of rounds of solitary confinement.
Oh, 3 times, yeah.
Did you like yourself well enough? Were you comfortable enough with yourself to be alone with yourself in confinement,
Terry,
like that?
Terry, solitary confinement isn't solitary. The times when it was solitary, when I was by myself, it was wonderful. It was fantastic. It was everything I could ever dream of. It was like being sent on vacation because all I had to do was read and do push-ups. But unfortunately, because of financial issues, solitary confinement isn't. You have a bunkie. You have a second person in there, and that was the trauma of solitary, the second person. But there are, you know, you can. It's the luck of the draw, and there was one time when I was very unlucky and got myself a madman, but the other times I was okay. It's just that the guys, they, you know, I had to take care of them. For one guy, I ordered all of Jules Verne so he could read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and shut up.
What defines solitary if it isn't the solitude, if it isn't being alone in a cell?
Well, you're locked in a room, two people locked in a tiny room for 8 months, Terry. It's mind-boggling. And the solitary units, which are specially built housing units just for this, they hum with activity from these locked-up men who they run gambling rackets and they make friendships and they fight. And it's life goes on. It's like flowers growing through a crack in the sidewalk. They manage by throwing lines to each other from cell to cell under the door. It's really actually kind of inspiring because it shows how the human spirit fights oppression. It doesn't allow itself to be trampled. It continues to live. It insists on living. Of course, what that meant for me was that my bunkie came in, when he came into the solitary confinement cell, in his anus was enough tobacco to buy up everything in the solitary unit, because tobacco is the currency there, since it's not allowed. And he had filled himself with quite a bit of it. This was called boofing, and I have an
what,
essay
hide,
on that.
Hiding it there is called boofing?
Yes. I have an essay on that called The Prisoner's Wallet. So the boofed tobacco, it's worth 10 stamps for one cigarette, and it enabled us to buy up every kind of little snack that we could get. From Christmas came around and Snicker bars were handed out, and we had 30 of them because the tobacco was so valuable. And he had the sense to bring in match heads and a striker. Everything has its own name, by the way. The match heads are our red tops. The striker is a skateboard, you know. Marijuana is Al Green. Tobacco is tobacco is Foxy Brown. I hope I'm not giving away trade secrets.
That's really funny.
I don't want to be a snitch.
Right, right.
Snitches get stitches, as you might have heard.
Oh, I hadn't heard that particular rhyme, but I knew the larger
truth
about
it. There's names for scars. There's even names for scars, okay? There's a telephone cut, which goes from your ear to your mouth, which you get for using a claimed telephone. There's a buck 80, which is a scar which requiring 180 stitches. There are curtains, which are two cuts down the face, which make your eyes look like they have curtains. There's the hook, which puts a hole in the cheek. But that's how... You know, these things sound horrible, but in reality, they kind of show that a culture of incarceration has arisen, and it shows that the human beings really aren't, we're more than animals. We make culture wherever we go, and we adapt, just like I had to. I had to adapt.
Earlier, we were talking about how, you know, your father is a, you know, very well-known Soviet dissident, how you grew up surrounded by, famous Soviet dissidents, and then you were in prison for stealing money to pay your drug dealer, something that must have really let down your parents because it was not for, a larger goal. You were not in prison for, a political cultural, literary.
Well, I
reason.
Don't think they would have been thrilled if I had been in prison.
No,
for anything. But,
but
I see what you're saying.
It would have represented something, though, that they could have understood and supported in a way that they wouldn't support. You know,
yes.
a drug.
But
habit.
They were.
But did they support
they
you once you were in prison? I mean,
absolutely. They were embarrassed, of course, but they helped me for years, Terry. They were the best. They brought my wife up. I lived on $100 a month for the entire 10 years, which was plenty. And they visited and they brought books. And I have no complaints, only gratitude for them. You know, the fact that I don't know if they're ever going to be able to totally forgive, but at some level, they've come to terms with it, that this happened, and I dealt with it. No one gives me a pat on the back for surviving, because I'm the dummy who went there, you know? So, of course, nobody applauds me for having survived, but I do applaud them, because they once drove 12 hours through a snowstorm to visit me. They brought me half of these 1,000 books that I read. And my father was kind enough to read sometimes the same books as me so we could talk about them. Or he would suggest something that he felt I needed to round out my knowledge in an area. And my mother was also important in understanding the emotions that I felt, you know. So they were all, and my wife is crucial. She stayed. My wife stayed. She waited 10 years.
And you had just gotten married before you were arrested.
We had seven months together, mm-hmm. and I was a terrible husband.
Well, you'd lied to her. She didn't know that you were an addict.
Well, she figured it out eventually, but mm-hmm. it took a while. And it was after the crimes. And I was all horrible. I mean, horrible. See, the thing is that I met her when I was sober, because during my two and a half years of addiction, I had an interlude, shall we say, in the middle when I was sober. And that's when I met her, and I wooed her, and I dated her, and we got married, and I relapsed immediately. And the poor woman had no idea anything about, she was naive to this stuff, you know. And she, I told her when I knew it was going to be a long time. I didn't think it was going to be double digits, though, but I knew it would be 5 years at least. And I told her, you know, you're young and you're beautiful and you're smart. You make whatever decision you have to make. I understand. She said she'd think about it, and she ended up staying. She was close with my family, and she had a job, and she was stable, and we're together now, and we love each other very much.
Do you think that you're a different person in many ways than you were when you were first imprisoned?
Well, Terry, for one thing, it's 10 years since I first went
sure,
to prison.
Sure.
So I'm
who,
a different
who isn't
person
after 10
just
years?
In that
right.
sense.
Yeah.
But prison has made me who I am, and it did it twice over. The first thing it did was make a man out of a boy, because even though I was a married man and I had a bachelor's degree from NYU and I worked in publishing and I had a business card with a picture on the back of it and a black and white Hyundai cell phone.
Wait a minute, didn't your business card say lifestyle consultant or something
artist,
like that?
Lifestyle artist.
Is that kind of obnoxious a little bit? Like, what does that supposed to mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. I was such a wannabe. I look back at myself because I saw myself, I was molded myself into what I knew how to be, a cultural figure. But the problem was there was nothing standing behind it. I'd never written anything.
Right.
So even though I had all the accoutrement, I didn't have the real stuff. And I was really just a boy in a grown man's clothing. But as soon as I got to prison, I had to either become a man or face the consequences. And the consequences aren't pretty, you know? And the evolution in my character is actually the greatest thing that could have happened, because prison made a writer out of me.
Well, Daniel Jenness, thank you for talking with us. I wish you good luck with your new life.
Thank you, Terry.
Daniel Jenness spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Jenness is writing a memoir scheduled for publication next year called 1046, which is the number of books he read in prison. Seymour, An Introduction, is the new documentary directed by actor Ethan Hawke. It's just opened in theaters, and our critic at large, John Powers, has this review.
As long as we're blaming baby boomers for everything, I'd like to add something to the inventory of grievances. It's the recent explosion of what we might call gerontological cinema, a pandering world of bucket lists and exotic marigold hotels, designed to reassure the zillions of gray-haired boomers that they're still alive and can still act like they're young. For an antidote, I prescribe Seymour, An Introduction, an inspiring new documentary by the actor Ethan Hawke. It's a loving portrait of his friend and mentor, Seymour Bernstein, an acclaimed classical pianist who quit a successful concert career at the age of 50 to become a piano teacher. He's a quintessential New Yorker who embodies the wisdom of age. Bernstein was well into his 80s when they shot the film, a puckish man with an unabashed love of music. Keeping himself mostly in the background, Hawke interlaces footage of his subject at work with scenes in which Bernstein, a gifted raconteur, tells the story of his artistic life, how he came from a non-musical Newark family, how as a small boy he heard Schubert's serenade and wept, how at 6 he begged for a piano. By 15 he was teaching, and before long he was on the concert trail. He played big halls, won admiring reviews, and even had a patron, a spiritualist millionairess who paid to launch him in Europe and put him up in a huge house in Scarsdale, where she had gifts delivered to his door every day. Although he would appear to have had it made, he always hated the commercial side of things and was tormented by a profound anxiety at public performance. And so he just stopped. You see, Bernstein's relationship to his music is inseparable from his sense of himself, as he learned early on.
When I was around the age of 15, I remember that I became aware that when my practicing went well, everything else in life seemed to be harmonized by that. When my practicing didn't go well, I was out of sorts with people, with my parents. So I concluded that the real essence of who we are resides in our talent, in whatever talent there is.
Ethan Hawke's talent is acting, and it's his own agonized relationship to it that first drew him to Bernstein and led him to make this movie. When I first heard about it, I was skeptical. I'd long found Hawke slightly pretentious, maybe because years before James Franco became a Renaissance man, he'd already tried it. Publishing novels, directing off-Broadway plays, directing films, starring in movies, and appearing on stage at Lincoln Center, where he was a terrific Bakunin in Tom Stoppard's Coast of Utopia. Now, ever since first making his name in Dead Poets Society, Hawke has been a seeker. And in Bernstein, he finds a real-life version of Robin Williams's teacher in that film, The One Who Shows You the Way. Bernstein is a model of how you sustain creative passion over decades and decades. Not that he's some sort of self-help swami dispensing mantras and bromides. You can tell that from watching him teach, at which he's obviously brilliant. As a meticulous artist, he believes in hard work. That's the only way to get good. At the same time, he takes his students through their lessons with an upbeat gentleness that's no less encouraging for being rigorous. J.K. Simmons wouldn't win the Oscar playing him. Everything Bernstein does is steeped in his love of music. The film opens with him working on his fingering of a Scarlatti sonata and ends with his first public recital in 35 years. One of the best scenes comes when he tests a group of pianos before a student recital. Every piano is like a person, he says, showing his knowledge of both. They build them the same way, but they never come out the same. Seymour, An Introduction takes its name from a Salinger story, and the title, though cute, is apt. This tactful film is only an introduction, not the whole story. While we do see Bernstein living alone with his Steinway in the cramped New York apartment he's occupied for 60 years, Hawke reveals almost nothing about this very private man's personal life. If he's had love affairs, kids, or breakdowns, we don't learn. Gossip isn't what Hawke is after. No, what he's after is no less than the secret of a happy, satisfying artistic life. Heck, of a happy, satisfying life in general. And the delightful Bernstein seems to have figured it out. It's not hard, really. Lead with your heart, Seymour tells us. Then practice, practice, practice.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Seymour, An Introduction. Our next guest, Norman Blake, has performed bluegrass music for about 60 years. In addition to his own recordings and performances, he played in Johnny Cash's band, played on Dylan's Nashville Skyline album, and on the nitty-gritty Dirt Band's Will the Circle Be Unbroken. He played progressive bluegrass with Vassar Clements and Tut Taylor on John Hartford's album, Aeroplane. On the soundtrack of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, he sang You Are My Sunshine and played a solo guitar version of I Am a Man of Constant Sorrow. T-Bone Burnett, who produced the soundtrack album, described Blake as, quote, one of a handful of the best acoustic guitar players in the world. He's learned hundreds of country songs, including rags, instrumental tunes, and fiddle numbers, knowing the influences and nuances of everyone. He should be an absolutely revered musician, unquote. Blake toured for decades with his wife, Nancy Blake. Now, at the age of 77, Blake has released an album of original songs called Wood, Wire, and Words. Terry spoke with Blake last Thursday and began with a track from the album called The New Dawning Day.
Flickering shadows and darkness tell all the years gone by. Humors of time, space, and places rise in the barren dark sky. But there's no reason to fear them, drifting in space, floating by. Faltering voices ask us, why, oh why? Now you can believe what you want to, as the winds blow cold in the night, when restless spirits haunt us between midnight and morning's light.
That's Norman Blake from his new album, Wood, Wire, and Words. Norman Blake, welcome to Fresh Air. Thank you so much for coming. You've literally and figuratively stayed close to your roots. You live down the road from where you grew up in Sulphur Springs, Georgia. You moved there, I think, in 1939 at the age of one. And you play music that's very connected to the music that you knew as a child. And I'm wondering, although you've toured around the world, what has kept you living so close to the home where you grew up?
I was raised in a very rural environment, no electricity, no real modern conveniences, no telephone. I always say the highest tech thing that we had was a battery-powered radio. And we ran that on a car battery that my father had rigged up, because the radio batteries that you had to buy didn't last very long and they were real expensive. And we had wind-up phonographs and things and few old records. So life was pretty simple, and the railroad train running through Sulphur Springs, Georgia was the biggest excitement. They ran 22 steam locomotives through there a day, passenger and freight trains. And so that was a big focus in my life. And it was just a real simple upbringing down on the dirt road and the railroad there in northern Georgia.
You have a lot of train songs in your repertoire. Would you play one for us? I know you've brought your guitar with you.
Sure. Let me get fixed up here.
Oh, yonder comes old FFV, the fastest on the line, running on that C&O road, 20 minutes behind. She's running into Sewell, headquarters on the line, receiving their strict orders from the station just behind. And when she got to Hinton, that engineer was there. His name was Georgie Alley, oh, with his curly hair. His fireman was Jack Dixon, is standing by his side, awaiting their strict orders when in the cab to ride. That's part of it. There's a whole lot more.
All right. You do a lot of story songs in your repertoire. So why did you choose that song? What does it mean to you?
Well, that's one I've heard all of my life. The Wreck on the C&O Road is the name of it. It's been recorded, in, I think, some 70 or 80 times over the years. The Carter family did it under the title Engine 143 in a different timing. They did it in 3/4 time, but it's about the same train, the FFV, the Fast Flying Vestibule, that ran on the C&O Road up in Virginia and West Virginia.
You play several rags on guitar on your new album, and it's one of the things you're known for. Let's hear an excerpt of one of your original rags from your new album. So this is the Chattanooga rag, and this is Norman Blake from his album Wood, Wire, and Words. That was Norman Blake playing his own Chattanooga rag from his album Wood, Wire, and Words. And he's in the studio. He's actually in a studio in Alabama with with his guitar. So, Norman Blake, you are very well known for your flat-picking style. How did you end up playing with a flat-pick?
Well, that goes back to the early days. I first learned to play guitar more in the style of Maybelle Carter and Riley Puckett and those people in the string bands. And I used a thumb and a finger pick, one finger pick. That's the way that the early bluegrass guitarist also played. Lester Flatt played that way. Carter Stanley, a lot of the guys, they all old-timers back in country music, played with a thumb and finger pick. And so I was playing that way for a while when I was learning and got into that. And along in the 60s, I was giving some guitar lessons and had a student that asked me, had I ever heard Doc Watson? And Doc had just made, I guess, his first records at that point. And I said, no, I hadn't heard him. And I had played the mandolin along at the same time, you know, with a flat pick. And when I heard the Doc Watson records, I thought, well, I've been doing that a little bit. You know, I know how to kind of do that. But I kind of looked at it as though it was a novelty at that point to my way of thinking. But I realized that people really liked that, so I started working on it myself and kind of developed my own way of doing it.
something that was very, I assume was a real turning point for you was meeting June Carter and Johnny Cash. You ended up playing in Johnny Cash's band off and on for years, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. I worked with Johnny from late 1963 off and on his recordings through the end of his life. Yeah. I think 40 years or so.
He was looking for a dobro player when he first hired you, and dobro was not your instrument. So did you lie to him? Did you tell him, sure, yeah, I play dobro?
No, actually, dobro was an instrument that I was playing a lot.
Oh.
I probably played dobro more than I did anything else for a while back early on in my life. So, no, I was really a dobro player as far as things were concerned. But he had never heard me play, and I went over there with a friend after I got out of the Army, this fellow named Bob Johnson that I was referring to earlier, the banjo player. And we had worked with June earlier down around Chattanooga on some local shows, and so he was going over to play a session with Johnny Cash, and he says, "You want to go over there with me?" And I didn't have anything else to do, so I went with him. And when we went in, she introduced me to John, says, "I've been telling you about Norman Blake," says, "he plays the guitar and the dobro and other things." And he turned right around, and he never heard me play a note. And he says, "If you can get a dobro," he says, "I'll use you tomorrow." He says, "I've been wanting to use the dobro and mariachi trumpets together." And, you know, he'd been using the trumpets, but he hadn't had the dobro with him. So that's something he wanted to do. So I started recording with him the next day. And like I say, it went on for off and on for 40 years.
What kind of advice, if any, did Johnny Cash give you about what he wanted in his band?
Well, I can tell you the first thing he ever told me in the recording studio was when I started playing dobro with him that first time. I started playing, and he says, "That's really good." He says, "But can," he says, "that's too good for one of my records." He says, "Can you play about half as much?"
What do you think he was really saying?
Well, he wanted me to keep it simple. Mm-hmm. He wanted me to play it on single strings, and he had his own way of wanting to do things, and he wanted things kept really sparse, you know, on those records. He was into that. He had a sparse sound.
So I'm going to play a recording of Johnny Cash singing one of your songs, and this is Chattanooga Sugar Babe. And I think you're featured on guitar banjo on this?
Yeah, it's an old Gibson guitar banjo like Papa Charlie Jackson used to play.
Okay, well, why don't we hear it? And this is Johnny Cash with my guest Norman Blake on guitar banjo.
There ain't no money to buy cocaine, sugar babe. There ain't no money to buy cocaine, sugar babe. Ain't no money to buy cocaine, burn your nose and rot your brain, sugar babe. Sugar babe. I woke up this morning, blues all around, sugar babe. Woke up this morning, blues all around, sugar babe. Woke up this morning, blues all around, throw on my rags and walk downtown. Sugar babe, sugar babe. Standing on a corner, don't you see, sugar babe? Standing on a corner, don't you see, sugar babe? Standing on a corner, don't you see, they haul me away for vagrancy, sugar babe.
That's Johnny Cash singing a song by my guest Norman Blake, who was featured on guitar banjo. And Norman Blake played in Johnny Cash's band for years, off and on. Was it through Johnny Cash that you got to play with Bob Dylan on his Nashville Skyline album? Because Johnny Cash sings a duet with Dylan on that, on Girl from North Country.
Yeah, my association with John... Bob Johnston, not to be confused with the Bob Johnson, the banjo player, but Bob Johnston was the producer was doing Johnny Cash for Columbia Records. And when Bob Dylan came down, he was also recording on Columbia, I believe, at the time. And Bob Johnston hired musicians for the Bob Dylan session, and I was included. That's how I ended up on that.
So what did Dylan tell you when you played in his band on the 1969 album Nashville Skyline?
He didn't say much of anything. Bob Dylan was very quiet at that point. He didn't say anything. He came in the studio, and he would run the songs down, you know, play them for us on his guitar and his harmonica. And Charlie McCoy was playing bass on the session, and Charlie would write down the number charts, they call them in Nashville, you know, the chord changes. And Charlie would pass out the numbers, and we would do them. We did most of them, as I recall, on either the first or second take. But he was never very verbal. He just was pretty quiet at that point, you know.
T-Bone Burnett invited you to be on the soundtrack from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which was, you know, the soundtrack from the film with George Clooney. And there were a lot of, you know, folk songs, traditional songs on there. One of the songs you do is You Are My Sunshine, which is, you know, an old song. I don't know if it's a traditional song or if we know who the author is.
Well, it is a song that is credited to the former governor of Louisiana, Jimmy Davis, and Charlie Mitchell, who was also a partner of his. Jimmy Davis and Charlie Mitchell are the writers.
Why don't we hear a little bit of that recording? And this is my guest, Norman Blake, playing and singing You Are My Sunshine from the soundtrack of the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I dreamed I held you in my arms, but when I woke, dear, I was mistaken, and I hung my head and I cried. You are my sunshine, my only sunshine. You make me happy when skies are gray. You'll never know, I love you. Please don't take my sunshine away.
That's my guest, Norman Blake, playing and singing from the soundtrack of the film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which was a huge bestseller. What impact did this album have on your life?
Oh, it made life quite easier for me and my wife, Nancy. We were able to get off of the road a little quicker than we might have, you know, due to the fact that it was good for us in a financial way.
Norman Blake, thank you very much for talking with us, and thank you for performing for us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Norman Blake spoke with Terry last Thursday. Blake's new album is called Wood, Wire, and Words. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancuri.